I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome back to Radio Times. Well, I had so much fun yesterday afternoon reading our guests' new books. Jules Feiffer's noir graphic novel Cousin Joseph is set in 1931. It involves Detective Sam Hannigan fighting trade unions and working for his mysterious and evil cousin who wants Hollywood to stop making movies that he considers anti-American. Edward Sorrell's new illustrated book, Mary Astor's Purple Diary, is based on a real Hollywood sex scandal in 1936. It involved actors having multiple affairs, a child custody trial, and yes, a diary. Sorrell weaves in his own life story growing up during the Depression. In fact, our guests have much in common, both in their 80s, born about 2 months apart, grew up in New York. They've both received many prestigious awards. Edward Sorrell receiving the George Polk Award for Satiric Drawing and the Best in Illustration Award from the National Cartoonist Society. Jules Feiffer won a Pulitzer Prize and Academy Award, Lifetime Achievement from the Writers Guild of America, and an inductee to the Comic Book Hall of Fame. And I'm thrilled to say that they both join us here in our Philadelphia studio. Jules Feiffer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
And a pleasure for us and to you, Edward Sorrell. Thank you for coming in as well.
You can call me Ed.
I will call you Ed. Excellent.
You can, as a matter of fact, you can call me Boy.
I will not do that, but I'd be happy to call you Ed.
Can I call you Ed?
Here we go. I have to say that Jules Feiffer just got married, and apparently his best man was Ed Sorrell sitting here. So you guys are good friends, right?
I don't know. I forgot already. I hope.
How long have you known each other? Well, you've lived sort of parallel lives.
About 50 years.
About 50 years. Did you meet over cartooning and your work?
I guess we met at Pushpin, was it, or Warren Miller?
No, I think it was Warren Miller was the first time I met you. Yeah.
Warren Miller was a novelist, now sadly gone these many years. This is back in the early 50s, and he thought we should know each other.
Mm-hmm.
So he did things like that, bring people
and
together.
And he was right, I guess.
So far.
So far.
Well, at that time, Jules was already appearing in the Village Voice, and everybody knew who Jules Feiffer was. I was a hack illustrator doing a lot of work for advertising agencies and doing anything for money. And Jules was my ideal. The idea of doing political, expressing your own ideas was something devoutly to be wished, and it didn't happen for some years after I met Jules.
But it did happen to you.
But it did happen, and Jules was a great inspiration to me.
Well, Ed followed me into the Village Voice and was there for, what, about a year or two?
Yeah, about 2 years.
Yes. But for a while, Ed and I, and along with a very dear and old friend of us, David Levine, who's caricatures for the New York Review of Books are well-remembered, just formed a kind of unholy triumvirate of bad boy political cartoonists.
My favorite kind, I have to say. Well, before I get to your books, because it is interesting that you grew up essentially in this, or close to the same neighborhood, you're just a couple of months apart. How much do you think just being in New York at that time helped Jules Feiffer to make you become a cartoonist?
Well, it was the Depression years, and one of the interesting outgrowths of the Depression in those times, very different from the Great Recession of 2008, is it somehow infused the have-nots, the poor people, with a sense of optimism, you know, with an energy level, and living in the very Jewish Bronx, or the Jewish Bronx neighborhoods, and Ed was also that way. And Brooklyn was Jewish as well. And boy cartoonists, boy artists who saw comic books beginning, saw this as their way out, and they infused it with a great ardor and energy and a sense of invention. And there was invention, and nobody was depressed about it. Everybody was convinced that they were going to end up on top. It was a wonderful world of illusion while World War II was gathering, while anti-Semitism was building up in the country. None of it seemed to matter. All of it we were convinced was not going to stop us.
Well, Ed, part of your book, you also do weave in some of your own story, your own life growing up. Sounds like your family was poor. I mean, poor maybe even by Depression standards.
Yeah. Jules lived on west of the Grand Concourse. I lived east of the Grand Concourse. Therefore, I was poorer than Jules' family.
I deny it.
No, my mother was the breadwinner. She worked. She was a machine operator in a millinery factory. Mm. My father essentially slept on the sofa, and there wasn't much money in that. But yeah, we were poor, and most of my mother's sisters. My mother is one of five sisters, and the ones that went to college, of course, all became communists, and a few of them became Trotskyites. So there was never a moment's peace in our family.
A lot of yelling and screaming about
politics.
A lot
of yelling and screaming, and I remember particularly Aunt Jeanette, who was the most rabid of the communists in my family, yelling at my grandfather, a tailor in the Bronx, because he read the Daily Forward, which was the Jewish socialist paper, and she wanted him to read the Jewish Day, which was the communist Jewish newspaper. There was a lot of that going on.
And how about young Ed? You were not Sorrell then, you were Schwartz,
no,
right?
I was Schwartz,
you
yeah.
You were Schwartz. What was young Ed Schwartz doing while
he was listening to the radio and going to the movies and said, someday I'm going to get a job that will let me have my own apartment. And I did not want to become an artist. I just wanted to get my own apartment. And since I could do nothing else except draw, I managed to do that.
I read, or you wrote, that you were bedridden for, what, about a year or so? And that was perhaps the beginning. You don't hear about children being bedridden.
Of course, you've got penicillin now.
Well, I was wondering
about
that. You've
got penicillin. And also, even if we had penicillin, I didn't have television. So there was nothing to do except make pictures. I mean, kids now, nobody can draw now because there's no need to.
But that was your start, being bedridden, listening to the radio?
Yeah. And fortunately, in those days, they gave cardboard with your shirts from the Chinese laundry. So I had something to draw on.
How about for you, Jules Pfeiffer?
Well, I picked up a pencil. It must have been as early as 3 or 4. Like Ed, my mother was the breadwinner in the family, but she was more middle class. She was a fashion designer, which means that there would be a large drawing table set up in the middle of our two-bedroom apartment, and she would do her sketches on that, and she would take them down to the Garment Center on 7th Avenue and go door-to-door and try to peddle these sketches. They sold for $3 a sketch.
Wow.
And they were watercolor line drawings that showed the stitching and the design and how you made it and all of that, and tried to look attractive, and they did. And on the basis of that $3 a sketch, she got us through the Depression, because my father, who was a sweet and gentle and wonderful man, once he came to America from Poland, couldn't figure out how to make a success. Everybody else, in his brothers and his sister, were all business people, were all successful, and were all thieves. And he was honest, and so, of course, he was broke. So he'd sit in the living room reading the New York Times or reading Victor Hugo and basically staying out of the way. So I thought he rented a room there. He had no authority. You asked him to do anything, he'd say, ask your mother. But once a day, he would make my two sisters and myself, a piece of Jewish rye and butter with a sliced carrot on it. And we looked forward to those moments. It was a wonderful moment of simpatica with him.
Oh, that's a fabulous story. And I have to say, going back to you, Ed, you talked a little bit about your dad. I mean, it seems like he was a scary presence in your family, or
he wasn't lovable, and I'd rather not talk about him. He was ignorant. He had a mean streak. No, he didn't beat me. No, there wasn't It wasn't any of that, but he was just insensitive. He was what?
Was there any sex?
Was there any sex between us? No, there's no sex between us.
Well, that's
us
good
either.
To know. That's
but,
good to know.
But he was profoundly stupid and insensitive. And on the other hand, he has stayed dead, so I shouldn't be too hard on him.
Well, it's interesting just how, I mean, your sort of parallel lives here, and both of your books set in the 1930s. I don't know how much of a coincidence that is, but obviously we're talking the Depression.
Well, the clue is that we're both in our 80s, and we're both going to be 88 in a few months, and that's what we know about. I mean, if I was asked to write, and no one has, a contemporaneous book, or graphic novel or whatever, I wouldn't know where to begin. I don't know the language. I don't know anything about the music or the drugs people take. I was a member of the booze generation and loyal to that. And, I mean, I'm just too stupid to know
how to handle it. Who are all those people on the cover of magazines?
I don't know.
Think stupid is exactly the right word.
Well, but it's interesting. You reach a certain age and you realize you've been dropped out of history. You've been dropped out of the culture. And so to get some norm back or sense of self back, I have to find an excuse to write about the past because that's all I know about.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Go ahead.
For me, it was there's something else too. The 30s were the last decade of Art Deco, and for me, Art Deco has a tremendous pull. I love the fashions, I love the designs, and so it was inevitable that if I were going to do a book, it would take place in the 20s or 30s. I just love the period. Aesthetically, I love the period.
And is there something about just I'm imagining it, I'm seeing it, something about just the shape, the architecture of it, even if it's a design?
Yeah, well, on an non-aesthetic level, it was also the last romantic age. When think of the songs that were being written, "You Are Love," Jerome Kern, Rogers, Gershwin. For us suddenly to be thrust into "Let's Do It in the Road" is a big jump, you know.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Edward Sorel, Ed Sorel, and also with us, Jules Pfeiffer. They need no introduction. I gave them a little one at the top of the show. They both have new books. Ed Sorel's new book, it's an illustrated book called Mary Astor's Purple Diary. We'll be talking about that. And Jules Pfeiffer's noir graphic novel is Cousin Joseph. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Ed Sorel, Edward Sorel, and Jules Pfeiffer about their lives, about cartooning. And we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Ed Sorel said to me during the break, ask us about how we almost stopped being friends. Go ahead, Ed Sorel.
Well, what you have to know is that while I didn't get along with my father, Jules didn't get along with his mother. And at some point, maybe I would say in at least 20 years ago, I suggested to Jules that we do a book together. And I would draw the pictures, but you write it, Jules. I mean, Jules was the far wittier writer than I was, and so he agreed to that. And the weeks went by, and the months went by, and there was still no manuscript from Jules, and I began thinking, Jesus, who the hell needs Jules? I could do this book myself. But finally, Jules, a manuscript arrived in the mail. My idea for the book was, since we were both complete completely lived in the movies as children, that it would be about a boy like us who went to movies every Saturday and would imagine himself as Errol Flynn or James Cagney or whoever he saw that Saturday matinee. And Jules says, that's great, that's great. It'll be wonderful. So the manuscript came in the mail, and it was all about this kid who hated his mother. And so at
which
that
is why he went to the movies, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, well, we all went to...
Hid out in the movies, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what we did. We hid out in the movies. And anyway, I said, Jules, I can't do it. So Jules got angry at me. I said, okay, Jules, you do the book, and I'll do something else. And, said, and Jules said, no, you do the book, I'll do something else. Well, I did the book, and Jules went ahead and... So furious at me, he wrote his own children's book. And, of course, his children's book became a bestseller. And mine barely got by. But I take complete credit for making Jules a children's book author.
Absolutely. You accept that, Jules Pfeiffer?
Well, the Ed's version of the story, it will be no surprise. It's a little different from mine. But essentially, those are... the Trumpian facts, but without him, I was so angry. I said to him, "You write your children's book, I'll write my children's book." And then I started to think, "Well, what could I write about?" And the only thing I could think of, Edge was about a kid who was a violinist, and who loved the movies. So I couldn't do a kid who had any of those attributes. And the more I thought about it, the more somehow it reduced itself to being a kid who wanted to be, surprise, surprise, a cartoonist. And it became this semi-autobiographical work, which became a book called The Man in the Ceiling, which, to my delight and surprise, I loved doing and discovered that I was now a children's book author when I never had any intention of becoming one. And now, these many years later, the book was published in 1994, and now in the summer next year, it's going to be a musical with its premiere in Bay Street Theater in Sag Harbor, with the book written by me, the music and lyrics written by Andrew Lipper, and produced and directed by Jeffrey Sella, who is the producer of Hamilton.
Oh, my goodness.
So it's all of this.
Look what you did, Ed Sorrell.
I know.
You made him a star.
And
as always.
As always.
And ironically, the children's book that I did at that time was the last children's book I did because I was happy with it and I didn't have to.
It was a beautiful book, beautiful illustration, and perhaps what it lacked in story it made up for in its qualities. And I own and I'm privileged to own one of the best illustrations in the book.
It was far, far better story than anything Jules could have written. But we'll forget about that.
We'll leave it at that. Well, I'm holding your book, Ed Sorrell, Mary Astor's Purple Diary. And I'm sure you've told this story a million times, but it's fascinating. These you were ripping up your linoleum floor in your kitchen in the 50s, 60s and discovered this tabloid.
I had just gotten married for the second time, and we had no money, and there was an ad in the paper for... railroad flat on the Upper East Side tenement for $97.14, and rent controlled, obviously.
Yeah.
And I ripped up the rotting linoleum, and under four layers of linoleum, we finally hit the wooden floor, and there were copies of the Daily News and copies of the Daily Mirror from July 1936. And in headlines the size of war declared were headlines about a custody battle in Los Angeles. Mary Astor was suing her ex-husband for custody of their daughter. And the husband had stolen her diary, in which she foolishly kept track of all her extramarital affairs, and he was threatening to ruin her career and
explain who Mary Astor was.
Yeah, she was.
Well, she was. She had been a silent screen star, and because she was, first of all, she was a knockout. I saw her when she was gorgeous. I saw her when I was 10 years old. I saw her in The Prisoner of Zenda, and I just couldn't believe that anybody could be that beautiful.
Mm. But most importantly, she was Bridget O'Shaughnessy in The Maltese Falcon. And that's an immortal performance.
Absolutely. Yeah. But you kind of fell in love with Mary Astor, I would say, based
on
the way you write about
when
her.
After I saw the newspapers, I got a copy of her autobiography. She had died. She had retired from the screen in the 50s. And she was still alive at the time that I found these newspapers, I think. And so I read everything about her. I read the four biographies of George S. Kaufman, who was her lover. They had a three-year bicoastal affair. Kaufman, incidentally, I thought was a wonderful, wonderful guy. I enjoyed his plays, and I thought he was a first-rate guy. I want to come back as George S. Kaufman, as a matter of fact, in my next life.
Well, there's so many delightful parts of this book, including your many drawings, but you also have a pretend interview that you do with Mary Astor.
Yes.
And I was interested in all the various questions you asked, including the one, so what kind of lover is a germ freak?
Well, he was. He refused to shake hands with people. He would hold out his hand, stick out his pinky, and then go pinky to pinky with whoever he was meeting so he wouldn't pick up germs. And so kissing was a big risk for him. Well, he had his phobias too, as you learn that when he was a young man, he was terrified of going up elevators in skyscrapers if it was going to a high floor. And so he'd have to talk to himself to get the courage to get into the elevator. So he had his phobias.
You had her answering your question. And, well, George likes his sex the way he liked bridge. He was no spectator. He was in or he was out.
Yes. And and as she says in another part of her diary, he fits me perfectly. I shouldn't go into this too much because, for one thing, George S. Kaufman's daughter is still alive, just as Mary Astor's daughter is still alive. I don't want to embarrass either one of them.
Have you heard from any of them?
I had an email correspondence with Mary Astor's daughter.
Oh, interesting.
I had met George S. Kaufman's daughter quite by chance during an intermission at a theater, and somehow or other I started talking to this woman who was a bit older than I, and a very nice woman, and then she turned out to be George S. Kaufman's daughter.
Wow.
And Louise Hirschfeld offered to introduce me to her, but I was afraid to meet her before I wrote the book.
Well, I hate to jump in here because it's a fascinating conversation and description, but let me just pose a couple of questions to you. Jules Pfeiffer, this is your new book, Cousin Joseph, a graphic novel, and it involves this detective and this shady. How would you describe Cousin Joseph?
Well, it's book two of what started unintentionally as simply a one-shot called Kill My Mother, which came out, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago, and as a graphic novel, my first. And I found myself, because of my loss of hearing, because of my moving out of the city of New York and to the east end of Long Island, I found myself having to look for some new method of doing my work. Theater in general, I thought, was didn't make much sense because I couldn't hear my own rehearsals. So I started fiddling around with a form I always loved in reading, which was noir fiction, and decided I would go back to my early childhood and my early childhood ambition, which was to be an adventure strip cartoonist based on certain heroes I had, named Will Eisner, who did The Spirit, and Milton Caniff, who did Terry and the Pirates at the time, and then Steve Canyon. And I, emulating all of these and emulating the great makers of noir film, Howard Hawks and John Huston and others, I started putting this together as a comic book. A literary comic book, which we now call graphic novel.
Yes, we do.
It's a fancy comic book, and I found that it was ideal for me in my present state because I could, I was the writer, I was the director, I was a cinematographer, and I wrote the screen. Not only wrote the screenplay, but I also cut the pieces of screenplay on as the director.
And does it feel like a movie to you?
Yes, it feels like a movie. Every page feels like a movie and a movie story. And it's as much or more fun than I've ever had doing anything.
Really?
And book two, which takes place in 1932, will be in a couple of years succeeded by book three, which I'm in the middle of now, called The Ghost Script, which takes place in 1953 and is about the Hollywood blacklist.
Oh, wow. Wow. And this is also about Hollywood and movies and un-Americanism and all of that,
yes,
and immigrants, I should say.
And oddly enough, it has echoes, although it was not intended, to everything, to the argument of today about patriotism and super patriotism and what makes us Americans and what doesn't.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Jules Pfeiffer, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about his new graphic novel, Cousin Joseph. Also with us is Edward Sorrell, Ed Sorrell. And his new book is Mary Astor's Purple Diary. Let me just read one of the little bubbles here without getting into a lot of detail. The character is saying, it's these immigrants, their fault. First, nobody wanted them in their own countries, so we let them in here, this crowd, who no one could stand in the first place, their looks, their religion, their manners. What were we going to do with them? Aggressive, pushy. We looked for some place out of the way. Our mistake, we gave them Hollywood. Nobody wanted it, no water, a desert, far away from anyone or anything that counted. Several things. One is obviously the Jews going to Hollywood.
Yes.
But the other thing about these immigrants that we certainly hear today.
Yes, yes. So it's the trouble with age is you discover that nothing changes. You know, that the fight you won 20 years ago and then won again 10 years ago starts from scratch. Whether it's creationism, which we remember from the Scopes trial in the 1920s, and we thought that's over and done with, and now it's back stronger than ever, over and over again. The Voting Rights Act, it begins from scratch because going way back, it was about so-called voters' fraud. All baloney and all based on racism. And do you think that's over? No. These fights exhaustingly have to be redone from the start. And increasingly, we have such a contempt for history and our past that we don't even know, except for the academics, that we've done this before.
Does that depress you? Anger you?
It angers me. It doesn't depress me. It makes me furious, but it also makes me understand that that's what the way it is, and you can't simply be satisfied with anger or depression. You have to go on because the results of the fight always are to win over the bad guys, and if you just get so depressed you give up, well, we know who wins.
How about for you, Ed Sorrell?
Well, what Jules describes made me stop being a political satirist. I didn't see any point. I had said all those things before. The hypocrisy remains the same. And it also made me a proselytizing atheist. I mean, I was always an atheist, but a lot of my cartoons became anti-clerical because it seemed to me that it was organized religion had become politically reactionary always, and they represented no change. And I mean, they wanted to go back before the Enlightenment, essentially. Mm. So something that we had taken for granted for the last three centuries wasn't to their liking. So, I stopped doing political stuff years ago.
So are you not watching the 2016 election?
I started to watch it last night, and it was too painful. I just shut it off. It was, you know, it starts the heart pumping, and you get angry, and you can't sleep.
Unhealthy?
You put on music, and you calm down. And
I eat it up because, among other things, I'm in the theater, and I've been done films, and this is the theatricality of this. Just enlivens me while the level of it makes me furious. But I think this, too, will work out well in the end.
You do?
Yes.
Why? Sort of like that depression optimism?
We at the Academy want to thank Donald Trump for all he's contributed to his own collapse.
Were you thinking about Donald Trump at all when writing Cousin Joseph?
No, because I wrote it before there was a Donald Trump in all of this. But it's the same issue. As I say, you don't need a Donald Trump. We had a Joe McCarthy, who's not mentioned often enough in terms of Donald Trump. And before him, we had a Pat McCarran, who was a Democrat. And before him, he goes back and back and back and back.
And before him, we had the Palmer Raids.
Yes, yes. And all of that figures in my third book, where I mention of this, how everything is improving because we keep learning our lessons. But what we have learned, really, the one lesson is that history has no learning curve.
That's Jules Feiffer along with Edward Sorrell, our guests in this hour of Radio Times. We're going to take another short break. We'll get right back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Edward Sorrell and Jules Feiffer. They've been drawing since they were little boys growing up in New York during the Depression. The inspiration for Ed Sorrell's new book, Mary Astor's Purple Diary, was discovering tabloid newspapers about a Hollywood scandal under the floor of his apartment about 50 years ago. The story has stayed with him ever since. Jules Feiffer's new graphic novel, Cousin Joseph, set in the 1930s, involves a private investigator, union busting, and Hollywood. And they join us on Radio Times to talk about their new books, also to talk about their life as illustrators, as cartoonists, as drawers. And you can join our conversation at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I actually ran across two comments that you both made about Fred Astaire and his influence on your drawing. For you, Jules Feiffer, you say, Astaire, who began as an escape mechanism, ended up in a very real, defining way how I drew, my attitude about drawing, and fulfilling the basic ambition of all my work, which was to make it look, as Astaire did, as if you hadn't done anything, that what you've done, graceful, elegant, and if it works, quite impressive, was knocked off in 25 seconds. Ed, you say, this might be a good time to explain why it's so important to be spontaneous when you're doing comic art. Anything that's labored ceases to be funny. It only works if it's easy. A good example is Fred Astaire's dancing. I think of the reason that we enjoy it so much is because it looks so effortless. The fact that it took hours and hours of painful rehearsal is immaterial as long as the finished product looks effortless. It's the same with my drawing. So you both draw from Fred Astaire, dancer extraordinaire.
Yeah, Fred Astaire was beyond praise. He was just wonderful presence on the screen.
And trying to capture that thing that he did on the page?
Well, beyond that, there was, growing up in the Bronx, you didn't have any role models for class. and he was our role model.
Of what a classy dancer looks like,
guy, yeah.
Rather than a hoofer of some sort.
And as a kid, particularly when you're a kid, and everything, at least in my case, was so hard, everything took such effort, excuse me, that to see what Astaire did and know what went into it, because it was written about, took months to do one three-minute dance and to make it look as if, shucks, I'm not doing anything.
Yeah.
That became a goal for me in all of my work, in the writing, and to give a sense, as I try to do in Cousin Joseph and Kill My Mother before that and in the current book, of a sense of immediacy on the page so that when the reader opens it, there's the illusion of the page you're looking at was just finished 2 seconds ago. It just happened.
Hmm.
To have it happen. And same thing with theater. I always wanted my plays to draw the audience on stage. They're not witnesses, they're participants, to feel they're in the moment. And it's of the moment that I'm so interested in. That all comes from Mr. Astaire.
Yeah. I'm always interested in how artists work. And to you, Ed Sorrell, it's hard for me to describe on the air. I think people know what your work looks like. I'm curious about your process, about how you create a drawing, an illustration.
It depends on how complicated the drawing is. If it's a relatively simple drawing, a single figure, I don't want to speak for Jules, but I think Jules' work is far more spontaneous than mine because while I love working directly on paper without tracing, I have operatic ideas. I love compositions with many figures and backgrounds. And so in order to do pictures of that operatic scale, you have to do a lot of preparation and you are forced on some level or other to trace. Whenever I can, I work directly on the paper, but when I want to do an ambitious picture, I have to know where I'm going.
Do you consider yourself self-taught? I know you went to art schools, but I also read that you weren't.
Well, I am self-untaught.
self-untaught. I like that.
art schools were a disaster for me. I went to Music and Art High School, and I went to Cooper Union, and at Music and Art, they just taught you to abstract. And at Cooper Union, they were still teaching you to work like Stuart Davis, do Art Deco, flat shapes. Now, flat shapes don't tell stories. Yeah. And, well, I like to tell stories as they did in the 14th and 15th and 16th centuries. All those paintings are telling stories, and I like telling stories. And that was considered a lower form of art.
Oh.
Stories meant Saturday Evening Post or Collier's Illustrations, and they weren't going to teach that low form of art.
Oh, that's fascinating. Jules Pfeiffer, in your book, there's scenes of fights, of fist fights, guys, you know, duking it out. And there's a great energy. Again, I'm at a loss for words exactly to describe what the scenes are. But one gets that sense of danger and physicality, and the what happens when two people are fighting with each other, literally physically fighting with each other.
Well, the cartoonist who was one of my major inspirations, Will Eisner, who did The Spirit, was unique in that when he had his characters fight, we're talking about the 1940s now. You felt the blow, and you felt the reaction, and it was not an illusion. It seemed to be very, very real, and it stayed with me always. So that when I got to this point of doing fights, and you can't do comic books without doing fights.
No, really.
For many years, my readers are familiar with the dances I've drawn. A female dancer, not just Fred Astaire, but a modern dancer. And she'd be leaping and pirouetting and doing everything. And then, having given up that form of work, I basically gave up the dancer mostly. And this is my modern way of dancing, my updated way of having a dance, this physicality between men, which is very masculine, very violent, but also it's staged like a dance.
Yeah. And you can see their faces. I mean,
yes.
It's... almost the scream, in a way.
Well, because they're actors on the page.
Right. Right. I'd like to add one thing, and that is that both of us have become much, much better artists than we were. I think we were both pathetic when we started.
Yes.
And we just kept getting better. What you do need, you need two things. You need an inability to do anything else except draw.
Or end up on the street.
And you need taste buds. You need to steal from the good artists instead of stealing from the bad ones. And that isn't as easy as it sounds. When I, on the few times that I tried teaching art, there were kids who loved bad artists. I guess what I'm trying to say is that if you're lucky, you get better.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in fact, I read a quote from you at about being in your 40s before you really felt like you
were... Yeah, I had a drawing that I could take pride in. This is true.
And I had to wait another 40 years before I could draw.
Do you mean that?
Yes. Yes, I always wanted to do adventure strips. I couldn't draw in that style. I couldn't draw realistically. I couldn't make it convincing. I didn't know how to handle a brush the way real cartoonists did and all my heroes did. And so I gave it up and settled for less, which was my Village Voice cartoon, which was a backup thing that made me happy and made me famous. And again, I thought that's the only way I knew how to draw until I started doing children's illustration. And that was a transition because each book required a different look, a different style, because I was controlled by my own narrative. And my drawing improved. Hmm. And I was amazed at the age of 80 plus when I began work on Kill My Mother that I could draw better than I've ever drawn before. As I said, my learning curve is painful, but slowly I got it.
Well, let me read the acknowledgments at the end of the yearbook. You say this accidental noir trilogy that began with Kill My Mother will end with The Ghost Script could never have been conceived or illustrated were I still living out a life of quiet resignation in Manhattan. The fortuitous circumstances that led to my abandoning the city for the East End of Long Island, where I found new life, new friends, and a new career as a graphic novelist, now brings me as much or more pure joy than at any time in my life. And it's so wonderful to read that from someone who's 80-something years old, that there's life ahead of you.
Yes. I mean, I can't walk, I can't breathe, and I'm a boy again.
Let me get some callers, and we've got Dave from, looks like Dave from Wilmington joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Dave. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call, Marty.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
I wanted to thank Mr. Swell and Mr. Pfeiffer for coming on the show.
Sure.
Mr. Pfeiffer, as a young kid, the book that you edited, The Great Comic Book Heroes, I checked that out every single week at the library, and that turned me onto a lifelong love of comic books, introduced me to the great Will Eisner. From there, I started, got into Jack Kirby and all the greats. I wanted to ask you very briefly, both of you actually, why do you think that graphic art, comic books, graphic novels, whatever you want to call them, are looked down upon by a lot of people because comics can do everything. And I think it's kind of a disservice that some people are like, sure, I don't read that stuff.
Well, Dave, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I'll give Jules Pfeiffer and Ed Sorrell a chance to respond.
Well, it's I urge you to take that question and put it in the back of your mind, because cartoonists have been asking themselves that question for years. It just gives pain. It's never going to be solved. There is a snobbery, although all of us were born doing pictures before we did words, and all of us were born doing doodles and closer to the cartoon. Once we become literate, that's swept to the back, and the combination of words and pictures, which all of us begin with, is forgotten as having anything to do with anything, certainly not art, and certainly not progress. And these forms are defined by the people in charge of them, the critics and the scholars, and they have made their judgments. And if you try to go against it, you're butting your head against the wall. And every once in a while, like Art Spiegelman with his brilliant mouse, you can break through. But it's not worth conjecture because it never ends up where you want it.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And again, Jules Pfeiffer, our guest. Also with us, Ed Sorrell. We're talking about their new books. We're talking about their life as illustrators, as cartoonists. Do you, Ed Sorrell, the same question? I mean, do you feel like we're in a trough here?
I think most graphic novels are junk. I think most movies are junk. I think most novels are junk. So I don't know why we expect any more from graphic novels than any other art form.
Does that mean you don't? I know you went to the movies a lot as a kid. You don't go anymore?
I certainly don't go as often, no. And I think it was Molly Haskell who made the observations that when movies stopped being a popular culture form and became an art form, they lost a lot of the joy that they had when I was a boy. I mean, I now see the movies that I saw as a boy and realize they were pretty awful and and predictable. And in the first 5 minutes, you knew who was going to die and who was going to end up at the end.
Well,
your book is about making movies.
Yes, an interesting observation. The front page, which actually opens up tonight on Broadway, featuring my daughter, Hallie Pfeiffer. Happy opening, Hallie.
Tonight?
Tonight. She told me that one of the things that amazed her during rehearsal is that everybody talked so fast. And I said, that's what they did in the 1930s. You know, they talk fast, they talk loud, they communicate back and forth. Words mean something, and they shout back and forth to each other. And it gave an energy that the screen lacks today, the theater lacks today. But it used to be that way as a norm.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. We have a tweet from Marsha. Did you say Jules Pfeiffer just got married? Congratulations. Could he tell us more about his new partner and how they met? Can you do that?
Yes, I can. Her name is Joan Holden. She goes professionally by the moniker J.Z. Holden. She's just done a fascinating series of articles on Lyme disease that can be found on the website 27E. She is a writer, she is a painter, and she is about the most brilliant woman I've ever known, and I love her madly.
And how did you meet?
I'm sorry, what?
How did you meet?
Oh, she was, when I started teaching out at the Stony Brook Southampton College some years ago, she was in my second year, I think, and she might have been in second class as well. And then after she passed on to other things and to other classes, I didn't see her for about close to 10 years, or something like that. And then a friend called her up and said, you know, I was 80. Jules is living out here alone, and I'm giving him a birthday party. He just turned 80. And can you pick him up because he doesn't like to drive? So she was my designated driver, and it all began slowly then, but it didn't really – it took a year for things to become serious.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Jules Pfeiffer. Both of you, Jules Pfeiffer, Edward Sorrell, thank you so much. Such a pleasure, such an honor to have you with us on Radio Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And Jules Pfeiffer's graphic novel, Cousin Joseph, and Edward Sorrell's book is called Mary Astor's Purple Diary. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Sign up for the newsletter. Listen to us on satellite radio. I'm Artie Moskowain. Thanks for joining us.